Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week our guests are the economics editor at The Bulwark and an MS Now anchor, Catherine Rampell, and South Carolina Senate candidate, Dr. Annie Andrews. Now remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You also can get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Tell your friends about us. Remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Superpower, Smalls, Green Chef, and Ultra Pouches, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it helps make this podcast happen. James, with your law degree, you're familiar with the counsel. If you have the facts on your side, pound the facts. If you have the law on your side, pound the law. If you don't have either, pound the table. Attorney General Pam Bondi at the House Judiciary Committee pounded the table because she didn't have the facts or the law on her side in the Epstein case. But with her sneering insults, with a burned book right by her side of talking points, she just didn't do it very well. You know, I must say, 6 months ago, I did not think that the Epstein issue would still be with us, and certainly not with us through the 2026 campaign. I was wrong. There are three reasons it's not going away. Number one, the dissembling by the White House and its subsidiary, the Justice Department. There clearly is a cover-up of some stuff. Why? Two, Ro Khanna, a liberal Democrat, and Tom Massie, a conservative Republican, are leading the fight for full disclosure. They have proven to be bulldogs, and they won't give up. James, Massie has a tough primary. Trump is running against him in May. We might want to consider going down there and campaigning against Massie, because that probably would help him, and maybe he could win then. But the third reason is those victims, the women who have courageously spoken up against the sexual abuse trafficking of Epstein and his accomplice, Maxwell, won't be silenced until the Justice Department ends its limited hangout approach. Just finally, there's a headline in Wednesday's Washington Post, quote, Epstein fallout rattles the globe. Many powerful people face consequences. That's true overseas, Great Britain. It's true in the private sector here, New York and Los Angeles, Boston. It's true in every place but the Trump administration.
Well, it's never going to go well. And if you think about it, it can't go away. I mean, what do you have? You have a really rich guy, filthy rich, as you'd say, with a glamorous woman who's harvesting young women around the world. You got princes and Ivy League professors and politicians and bankers and sports organizers. And then you got all of that. And then you got a dead body. And then you got secrecy everywhere. And it's not going away. 30 years from now, they're going to still be digging through that stuff. They lied about everything. And I will say this. I believe, I don't have any memory of it. You have more men than I do. Anybody, has there ever been worse congressional testimony in history? In history than Pam Bondi. And they're frustrated, and they're going to stay frustrated because there's nothing you can say to make this go away. Nothing. And there's so much shit we don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said, look at the consequences over in Great Britain. Look at what happened to Wasserman out in Los Angeles. Look at what happened to the Goldman Sachs Council in New York. They're all gone. But the contrast is, how about Howard Lutnick? Howard Lutnick, not only associated with Epstein, but I think he went to the island. And he lied about it.
Mustang took his family and his nanny.
Yeah. And he suffered nothing. They don't call that intellectually challenged chairman, James Comer, hasn't subpoenaed Howard Lutnick to come up and testify before that committee, much less Donald Trump's. Now, you know, to be fair, there can be some there can be some guilt by association here. Joe Rogan ended up in the Epstein files because Epstein wanted to get on his show. I mean, he's not part of this. And even David Rubenstein, the rich private equity executive, probably unwisely held a meeting with a 20-minute meeting with Epstein for some charitable cause. And that was it. You know, I'm sure he regrets holding the meeting, but he's not part of the Epstein files as we know him. But Howard Lutnick and others are, and no one has held them accountable yet. And of course, this Justice Department will never do that because they are more culprits than they are investigators.
Remember, November. In a year, we'll know everything because Howard Lutnick is going to have his sorry ass dragged for many hours of testimony before a congressional committee. It's all going to change.
Right.
And the bullshit, you know, one of the reasons is, you know, vote Democratic. You'll get a chance to see the Epstein files. By the way, the public gets this completely. We're not trying to explain something they don't understand. They completely understand it. Doesn't need a lot of explanation. They think it's a really serious thing. There's so much trouble in this. It can't go away. It can't. There's more to come.
No. I agree. And I do think the range that Khanna and Massey represent, I think is really typifies the reactions to this. And as I said earlier, they have done a hell of a job. They won't let go of this. And Pam Bondi can insult as many people as she wants to do. She can stiff those survivors as much as she wants to. But, you know, I can't think of a worse congressional testimony. So right now I'll stand by your verdict.
I can't think of, I used to choose a lightweight, did more like a bantamweight, featherweight. I don't know. That was really bad. And I mean, the whole thing. And sometimes you wonder, and I wonder this all the time, maybe it's just because of where I grew up or, you know, where you grew up. They're not kind of embarrassed for their kids or siblings or family or mothers or something. I mean, if you make this big of a fool of yourself, I mean, like all world fool, does it bother you? Did it have the sense? I always wonder, these people have the same sense of shame, embarrassment that people like us have? I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. I don't know. The Christian knows.
James, I think she only cared about one person, and that was Donald Trump. Sure. And Donald Trump loved that kind of testimony because that's what Donald Trump is all about. And I think she cared much more about Donald Trump than relatives, than associates, than anybody else.
Maybe she'll explain that to us in the memoirs. It's great. I mean, I believe that, but it just at some point to please one person, how much damage are you willing to do yourself? I mean, the one that gets to me is Bill Cassidy. Yeah, yeah. He just makes fools of himself. He's not going to work out for you, man. Get over it. The guy he stabs you in the back, yeah. And all he does is come up, smile, and say, "Might have another." But the Pam Bondi stuff was beyond anything. And this is the person that says, "You have no right to question me. You just appropriate me and shut up. And it's going to happen."
I loved, what's his name, Moskowitz from Florida, says, "Hey, look at your burn book. Give me the best you got. Come on, give me your best shot." She froze. She didn't know what to do. James, we ought to tell our listeners, our viewers, that you are, I guess, what, 5,000 or 6,000 miles away down in New Zealand. What else is on your mind from that vantage point? Any other issue we ought to talk about?
You know, a lot of the same stuff is on my mind. Clearly, the technology is as good as it is in New York. I guess what's really on my mind, continues to be on my mind, is the coming elections. And, you know, we could do some damage to ourselves. We could do some damage to ourselves in Texas. We could do some damage to ourselves in Michigan. I feel like we could do some damage to ourselves in Maine, although I'm not completely sure it's going to break out. When you got a freight train that's moving at this speed and careening toward a big election like this, the ideas don't get in the way of the train. But you know, we'll have to go through some of this.
You know, one thing we ought to do before we go is we ought to have just a brief moment about Jesse Lewis Jackson. He was a really formidable figure in American politics. He sometimes would drive people crazy. But he really did play a big role that 84 and 88 campaign. Both the Mondale and the Dukakis people would tear their hair out sometimes at, his annex. But I think he helped pave the way for Obama 20 years later. And he actually, you had a run-in with him in the 92 campaign. But I think Jesse at the end campaigned for you.
Yes, he did. He got very vigorous in Boston. I think in 84 and 88, I think Jesse came to realize that the power he had was actually destructive to the cause that he was trying to pursue. So,
yeah,
I think he was correctly figured, and that's why we need more people like that. Like, look, I want to try to win this thing, and I'm gonna get on board with what I can do to help win it at any point. He did, and he and President Clinton were good friends. And I know that Jesse would have said, I did a lot better sticking around, being part of this. But he had, in 84, you could imagine, 88, a lot. I mean, they would negotiate how much the campaign plane and campaign staffing and things like that. I mean, it was some pretty arcane stuff, but it was pretty detailed what he would demand.
And in 84, he ran against maybe the toughest Democratic field in modern times, with a possible exception of 08. I mean, it had a former vice president, a former presidential nominee, senators, governors, national icon. He did well. And I think the one thing that infuriated me this week is the tributes to him, I think, were so deserving. Trump paid tribute to him, but he had to be cheap. And he had to say, basically, he was so much better than Barack Obama, who he hated. No, he didn't, Trump. He hated everything you stood for.
Yeah, if Trump ever did the polite thing, the decent thing, the human thing,
the gracious thing.
Specifically him. He lacks something that humans have. He lacks any empathy for anybody else. He lacks any understanding or curiosity about the world around him. I mean, how much can one person spend with one's head? Because that's all he does. Most people will try to fake it, but he doesn't even do that.
No, in that sense, he is authentic. Hey, another story this week, James. The Texas Senate candidate, James Tallarico, probably got a big boost when he was supposed to be in the David Letterman show, and the CBS lawyers really nixed it because they were afraid of Brendan Carr, the FCC chair, who says he might impose equal time restrictions on him. That was just utter nonsense. I don't know who was going to get the equal time, whether it was Jasmine Crockett, his left-wing opponent, or the Republicans. But what Letterman very wisely did, he went public with it, and he then put it on YouTube, and I think he got 2 million followers. Tallarico, I think, couldn't have done better. But let me just a word quickly about Brendan Carr and his threats. Trump was not elected FCC chairman. That's supposed to be an independent post. This man is a partisan hack. He has complained about equal time on Colbert, on Jimmy Fallon. He's never once mentioned Fox News. He's never much mentioned the Gutfeld show, which has its guests are overwhelmingly conservative Republicans. That's their right. I don't think he should mention it. He ought to stay to the business of regulating at the FCC, not get involved in partisan, but he is really, really a hack, James.
Well, evidently, he was put there to be a hack. I mean, it was kind of truth in packaging.
Yeah.
Everybody knew what his job was to do. You know, and of course, the thing with CBS, when things don't work for you, things just don't work for you. And they're having a hard time getting established over there, I think. And they've had a lot of resignations and a lot of people quitting, a lot of people leaking. I guess that comes with territory. Got an organization that old and that entrenched, and you come in and you say we're going to change everything you do, and then people resist that change. Pretty clear.
Yeah, no one today would call it the Tiffany Network. That's for sure. But big boost for James Tallarico. Hey, James, our favorite, our very favorite economic journalist is back, Catherine Rampell. She's wearing a different uniform. She left the Washington Post and now is writing for The Bulwark, which has long been one of our favorites, and she is as sharp as ever.
Thank you.
Catherine, first of all, thank you for being here. But a quick glance at the economy. You know, Trump says inflation is slowing a little. It really sort of is, not much, but a little. Jobs steady, sort of right. Stock market soaring. Trump and that renowned economist, Pam Bondi, say it's all working. What's wrong with that analysis?
A few things. So, look, the economy has not crashed. I know that many of us were very concerned that Trump's trade wars, among other idiotic economic policies that he's put into place, might cause significant damage to the economy and in fact, force a recession. And we haven't seen that happen yet. However, there are a lot of fragilities in this economy. You point out that inflation is still elevated. It's come down from its peak a few years ago, but it is still much higher than the Fed wants it to be. And that is largely because of tariffs, as well as some other factors. Beyond that, the job market is also pretty frail right now. The last month, January, looked decent, certainly better than expectations. However, the jobs from the prior year were dramatically revised downward. That is, like, once the Bureau of Labor Statistics got more information, got more companies responding to surveys, changed their models, et cetera, it turned out that hiring was just much weaker. In fact, we added fewer jobs over the past year than during the average month of the Biden administration. So the job market is substantially weaker than it used to be. And on top of all of that, one of the things that may be keeping the economy going, that may be sort of offsetting some of the negative consequences of the trade wars and deportations and other damaging policies that have been put in place, is what I would refer to as the AI bubble. Certainly, there's a lot of investment in AI that is good or that will pay off. But we don't know what's going to pay off and what's not going to. And there's probably a lot of bad money chasing after good. And that is propping up quite a bit of the real economy, but especially the market. So when you hear Donald Trump and Pam Bondi, for that matter, bragging about what's happening in the stock market, that's largely driven by a handful of companies that are very heavily involved in the AI space, and that doesn't seem sustainable. Like, somebody's going to win that war. There's going to be some kind of, like, winner take all within AI, but there are going to be a lot of also rans. And when they pull their money out, you're going to see, at the very least, a collapse of investment in that sector. And then the real question is, how does that affect the rest of the economy?
Yeah, I want to return to AI in a moment, but we're political hacks, so not you, James, and I. Let's look ahead to the fall election. Republicans are now saying those tax cuts from the big, beautiful, or ugly bill will just goose up the economy, and it's going to create a tremendous environment. Are they?
I do think that they will create some stimulus. That's certainly true, like some near-term demand stimulus, meaning that, like, companies are going to have a little more money to play with, and that'll be like a little sugar high. Whether or not that has enduring positive effects on economic growth, I think, is a completely separate question, because that's not the argument that they make, right? The argument that they make is that if you cut taxes on corporations in particular, then that's going to lead to more investment. That's going to lead to more capital being pulled into the United States. And over the long run, that will increase our growth rate. And they said that that would happen after the 2017 tax cuts, the TCJA, and there's very little evidence that, well, very little evidence that it came anywhere close to paying for itself. Maybe it helped growth a little bit, but not nearly as much as it actually cost. This time around, I think you'll probably see something similar. But in general, you know, it will provide a nice little boost in the near term. We have in a bunch of different ways, we actually have policies that are helping run the economy a little bit hotter than it otherwise would be, just coincidentally leading up to the midterms.
Let me go back to tariffs, because I see a conundrum here. I really thought they would be more inflationary than they have been so far. So I want you to tell me why I was a little bit off on that, and also what will be the impact if the Supreme Court tosses them out?
Sure. So this has been a frequent question. Why is it that the tariffs have not led to like the huge surge in inflation that many people would have predicted, and it, myself included? And there are a couple of things to keep in mind. One is that a lot of the tariffs that Trump threatened or promised did not materialize. You know, the Trump always chickens out the taco trade. You've heard this term, right?
Right, right, right.
So Bloomberg actually did an analysis looking at how often Trump carried through his tariff threats. And it was only about 25% of the time. So 75% of the time, he says a tariff is going to come and it doesn't come.
Right.
Because it gets delayed or it gets suspended or whatever. So partly it's that the tariffs are just not as high as they initially sounded, but they are pretty high. So don't get me wrong. So then the question is, the ones that 25% of the time that they have been implemented, why has that generated more price growth? And I think it's partly related to your second question about the Supreme Court. There are a lot of companies that have been betting on the idea that the Supreme Court is going to strike down these tariffs. So they are absorbing the cost and they are doing what they can to avoid passing it on to customers and avoid passing on the entirety of that cost to customers, because they don't want to piss off, frankly, their customers by raising prices. And they're holding out for the idea that they're going to get that tax money back, that tariff money back. A lot of companies that I've talked with have basically said this, that they've sort of penciled in this idea that like they're getting a big rebate check at some point soon. And so they're, if, you know, like there's a company that I, CEO that I talk with periodically who imports artificial Christmas trees from China. And he was saying that basically like they have raised prices, you know, something like 10%, you know, leading into during the Christmas season, but that's not nearly as much as the tariffs that they're having to pay. So they're just like holding on for a little bit, hoping that they get that money rebated back, and they haven't yet.
You mentioned AI earlier. It is, and I admit, to say I'm ignorant about AI inflates my understanding of it, but I know it's huge. I know it's transformative. Some people say, I mean, almost everyone say it's transformative. Some people say it will be minimal dislocation. We always adapt. Others say, no, we could lose tens of millions of jobs. Why isn't there an easy case that there ought to be some regulation of something so big?
Well, regulation of what is the question? Like AI is a little bit in the eyes of the beholder, right? How is AI different from algorithms that companies have always used? It's a little bit hard to define. Like, what is the thing that we are regulating? Now, you could say maybe we would regulate particular uses of technology that we think could be damaging. So that might include, for example, the ability to generate, nudes of minors, which is the case that, you know, but something that has been a problem to date, including on sites like Twitter/X, that you can use their AI functions to create, you know, to commit other kinds of crimes or things that would otherwise be kinds of crimes. So you could limit certain uses, but I think it's very hard, like saying we're going to shut down AI. I don't even know what that means.
No, I'm not saying that, but if some of the smart economists say it could cost tens of millions of jobs. I mean, that's not a flaky viewpoint. It may not be right, but there are smart people that say that. Well, the government, the public sector has some role in that.
Yeah, I just think you can't turn back the clock on economic change or economic progress. And again, at some point, the horse is out of the barn. And so if let's say the United States says, like, you can't automate more services that are currently performed by humans, like graphic design, just as an example.
Right.
You can't legislate that around the world. And I'm not really sure that you want to. I think the better approach, the better response, and this has been the case throughout prior periods of really big technologically driven job dislocation, is to figure out how do people manage the transition. Because you can't stop technological change. It's a losing battle. Just like you couldn't have banned, it would not have been a good thing to like slow down the adoption of automobiles to save the horse and buggy industry. Or, going back to the original Luddites were about, I think, automatic looms. It's not going to be effective. It's going to be very hard to manage. And I think ultimately, in terms of helping people's living standards, it's not going to be useful. So the better thing to do, but it is a very challenging thing to do as well, is to figure out, how do you help people manage job loss and retraining? How do you have a sufficient safety net and a way to help people adjust? Like, in some ways, how is this any different from travel agents getting displaced by online booking systems? You know, like, banning online booking systems is not really going to be, in the long run, something that helps people's lives, or it just delays the inevitable, I guess is maybe a better way to put it.
Except this is much bigger.
It is much bigger.
James?
Oh, thank you. I'm going to read to you an opening graph of an article I saw in Fortune yesterday. The United States is rapidly accelerating toward a definitive tipping point. This Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, blah, 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 unsustainable, 120% of GDP. I remember when I first came up to Washington and all people did was talk about the debt, the deficit. What are you going to do? Fiscal rectitude. Democrats spend like drunken sailors. No, you're giving a drunken sailor's bad name. And we had the Graham-Ladder bill, and we had this, and we had that, and we had to have
all the blue ribbon commissions. Yep.
God knows what. And I don't hear a single, is this a problem, or am I making some shit up, or it doesn't matter as long as you pay the debt back in your own currency? What's the current avant-garde economic thinking about the accumulation of debt in the United States? Or is it just me being old nanny hammering?
No, it's bad. It's definitely bad. The problem is nobody can predict when we're going to feel the effects of the badness, if that makes sense. You know, like we have been outspending what we take in for most of modern history, and you know better than I do, there were only a couple of years when we had a surplus and we were actually able to pay down some of that debt. And because there has not been the same sort of market response, you know, what's your line about wanting to come back as the bond market?
Right.
Pardon?
I'm correct. That's the bond market. Yep.
That was supposed to be the most powerful thing, right? The all powerful thing.
Right.
And bond markets have not lashed out quite as much as one might have predicted back when you made that comment, right? If we had told you then what the debt to GDP ratio would be in 2026, you would have been like, oh my God, markets would freak out. They would never allow this to happen. And that hasn't happened. And part of the reason why is I think we sort of become inured to it. And everybody sort of assumes, like maybe we can keep going along this way until we can't. And of course, the fact that we have the world's reserve currency means that other countries are willing to continue lending to us, even if the same set of circumstances were the case in any other country, that debt would look more toxic, right? Like, the fact that we do have so much debt relative to GDP should make it something that like investors don't want to lend to us because it just looks too risky, but it's not. It's considered not risky because everybody else perceives it as not risky. And we are believed to be a stable democracy that pays back our bills. Some of those variables are changing today, in part because we don't look as stable, as credible. We've had, even before, you know, recent threats to rule of law and whatnot, we flirted with defaulting on our debt in the form of not raising the debt ceiling. We've had, of course, Donald Trump talking about trying to negotiate down our debts. We've had Donald Trump potentially trying to debase our currency in the form of putting a lackey in charge of the Federal Reserve. So there are a lot of reasons to think that like the thing that has shielded us from the wrath of the bond market, i.e. the fact that everybody wants dollars, may not persist. Now, I don't think that, I'm not trying to say that like all of a sudden the dollar is not going to become the reserve currency and we are going to completely lose that privilege, because the problem is there aren't a lot of other places for investors to go, but it has shielded us to some extent from the dire consequences that you are right to be worrying about. The question is like, if, you know, what's the expression that if something can't go on forever, it won't? I just don't know when it won't continue going on forever.
It's like some guy smoking 3-pack cigarettes a day. It says bad things are going to happen to you. Well, it ain't going to happen to you tomorrow. Well, but I don't know if it's going to happen to you tomorrow, but it's going to happen to you. I promise you. I mean, it's it.
So you only live once, right?
We bring up the dollar. It's okay. Some sophisticated guy, she picked up a copy of The Economist. I'm flying over Auckland, New Zealand. As you know, it's quite a little joint. And they had a whole cover story on a dollar. And of course, I've been an international traveler. I'm more dollar cognizant than I would be.
Yeah. Everything's getting more expensive for you when you travel, right?
I think we're doing okay vis-a-vis New Zealand, but I'm not too sure. But at any rate, they pointed out we've already lost a lot of value. If somebody in Europe invested in our stock market last year in dollars, they would be down.
Yeah.
The currency has lost more than I thought that was fascinating. But
yeah, we lost actually the dollar depreciated against every major currency last year. Everyone.
Mm-hmm. And the weak dollar has some benefits, but it also has a lot of detriment too, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, not only because if you're a world traveler like yourself, James, and you're going abroad, you know, your dollar doesn't buy as many whatever euros and yen and whatever else as it used to. It also means we can't buy as many imports here in the United States. And, you know, imports are already getting more expensive.
So is it just me or is it a data bank on this? Because economic revision, you know, come in and say, well, it created 196,000 jobs in August. And then come back and say, no, it was actually 102,000. I mean, we've always had those. It seems like, is there any research on this, that the revisions are getting bigger and bigger? Or is it just still randomness, you think?
So you're right that there are always revisions. And there are kind of two things that are going on that might make them seem bigger. One is that the response rates to the surveys that a lot of these data are based on have gotten worse. People are just less likely to answer the phone. They're less likely to return written surveys and things like that. So there is a little bit more margin of error maybe than there used to be. I don't know exactly what the quantity is. I just know that this is an issue with response rates. The second thing is, so that's a longer term trend. The second thing is sort of a cyclical issue, which is that whenever there is a turn in the economy, you always get bigger revisions. You always get bigger uncertainty or bigger errors. And the reason why is that for job growth in particular, that's based on surveying companies about how many jobs they create, how many people that they add, and how many people that they lose, right? And when the economy is turning south, companies close. And so they just stop responding. So you lose those companies out of your sample. The only companies that are responding are going to be disproportionately the ones that survive, which is going to make the numbers look stronger than they otherwise would. Does that make sense? So it's like when the economy is turning, you get it's just harder to measure because you don't know, like, are the numbers looking stronger because the companies that were shrinking went out of business and they just stopped responding to your samples, so you only disproportionately get the good ones. And the same thing kind of happens when the economy is getting stronger. You get new companies that are being created and you don't have those in your sample. And so it's just this complicated technical thing. And it's not like some grand conspiracy theory. It's just really hard to measure. And it requires, it requires doing revisions and finding other ways to get the data that might have otherwise been missing from your sample. And of course, it is also an opportunity for demagogues to take advantage and to say, aha, this must have been a big conspiracy to like make the economy look better or worse than it actually was, when in fact, it's just an artifact of, how the difficult methodology of surveying people and surveying companies. And just to put a final point on the thing that I think you may be asking is also, can we trust the numbers? Is that what you're sort of getting at?
Given you a form to answer in any way that you deem necessary, okay. But anything they say, I agree with a high degree of skepticism to start with.
So, because I get asked this a lot, like, can we trust the jobs data? And I write a lot, I report a lot about threats to our statistical agencies. So this is something that I am, in general, like, well attuned to pay attention to. For the economic data so far, I am not worried. Like, there are firewalls in place, and the people who work at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, for example, are career professionals who would be, raising hue and cry. Like, you would hear them everywhere if somebody were like messing with the numbers, which Trump clearly kind of wants to do, right? He fired the head of this agency, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. I am not worried about those numbers being deliberately cooked. I am worried about defunding of the agencies. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, I think, has lost something like 10 or 20% of its staff since Trump took office. And the same thing for the Bureau of Economic Analysis, which produces the GDP numbers, and a lot of other statistical agencies. So it's not necessarily like they're sending someone in to infiltrate and to, move some decimal points around. It's like they're cutting staff, they're cutting expertise. And so the problems that I mentioned before about, like, it's gotten a lot harder to collect accurate data, that only gets worse when you don't have the manpower around. So I'm more worried about that kind of sabotage.
So Roger Altman agrees with you, and he says there's so much independent data. If they tried to do something outside the norm, we would know anyway. I mean, the government's not the only people collecting data.
That's so true for some things, but not everything. But yeah, go on.
I'm going to ask you a question that makes center-left economists, I don't know, it really makes right-wing audiences uncomfortable, so I'm going to put it to you. Take any reasonable time frame you want, this century, 50 years, into World War II, I don't care. And you take anyone, and the economy under Democratic presidents has performed substantially, not better, substantially better. In fact, one author that studied it said it's not even close. Why do we have such a hard time dealing with the absolute, uncontrovertible, definitive fact that the economy under Democrats just overperforms that under Republicans? Why do people have so much trouble saying what is fucking obvious?
You have a problem.
Is what I say true?
That is true. Whether it is causal is a separate issue, right? Like, so we don't have that. Yeah.
But
so,
that just is over 80 years, over 50 years, over 20 years.
But it's not that many
days. At some point, you say there's a pattern here.
Mm-hmm.
But no one wants to say it. I'm socially liberal, but I'm fiscally conservative. Actually, I want to say I'm just the goddamn opposite. I'm culturally centrist, but I'm economically aggressive. Yeah, I want to tax you and give that money to a young person. They don't want to hear that shit. And if you did that, if you want to argue causation, you can. But every time we raise taxes on rich people, the economy shit takes off. Maybe we ought to do it more.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, you want to get the word out. I get it.
Go ahead, Catherine.
Well, I was going to say that, again, we don't have that many data points. And up until the current administration, I would have said presidents have very, very little control over the economy, right? They get too much credit when the economy is good and too much blame when the economy is bad. I have been saying that myself and others, but I've been saying that like over and over again for years, that there's, you know, they don't have like a dial on their desk that can turn down unemployment or turn down prices or whatever. Like, we wish that they had that much power, but they are just not omnipotent or not even like that potent, I guess. I would have said that up until the current administration. So it turns out, presidents cannot do that much to like improve the economy. They can do like little things around the edges that may not pay off immediately. But it turns out, if you really want to wreck the economy, you can. That is what we have learned from Donald Trump, right? That he has done a lot of very destructive things that, as we started out by saying, like, haven't, to our knowledge, plunged us into recession yet, but will have significant deleterious effects on the economy going forward. You know, and so I don't mean just like maybe they'll raise prices a little bit here and there. He's destroying our relationships with our allies. He's destroying rule of law. He is keeping talent, you know, the best and brightest talent out of the United States by shutting down visa programs and things like that. He's degrading our statistical agencies by defunding them or worse. And he is, potentially politicizing the Federal Reserve, or at least calling into question the independence of the Federal Reserve. All of those things will be very bad for the economy, even if we don't feel them immediately. And those can be directly traced back to one person in the White House. But a lot of other economic outcomes to date, you know, nobody's tried to do anything like this blatantly bad, maybe with the exception of like Herbert Hoover, I guess, you know, the last time we had major trade wars. But for the most part, presidents just like don't have that much power.
Okay, but we will say that over any time frame, for whatever reason, the economy under Democrats is substantially overperforming under Republicans.
I do not dispute that. I'm uncomfortable with assuming causality.
Maybe they're just lucky.
Except for right now. What?
I think you got her on that, James. And there have been some other demonstrably bad policies, Catherine. Nixon's wage and price controls clearly came back. But let me ask you just quickly about two people in particular. Kevin Warsh, tapped by Trump to be the next chairman of the Fed, been portrayed by conventional wisdom as well. He's the best of the choices. He's a conventional conservative. You're skeptical. You have written, you think he's going to be far more accommodating. He's more accommodating to Republican presidents. And I wonder if you think he made a deal with Trump beforehand to cut interest rates a couple times this year.
I don't know that he needed to make any secret backdoor deal. He said publicly he was going to cut interest rates, or he was in favor of cutting interest rates. And the reason why I am skeptical of him, as you sort of alluded to, is that he seems much more interested in cutting interest rates when Republicans are president than when Democrats are. When Democrats are in office, he is a major inflation hawk. He wants tighter monetary policy, whether in the form of interest, you know, higher interest rates or shrunken balance sheet or whatever. And then when Republicans are in office, particularly Donald Trump, just coincidentally, that's when he decides, you know what, we really need to stimulate the economy with looser monetary policy. He made an about face the first time Donald Trump was president, when Trump coincidentally happened to be looking for a new Fed chair, and he made an about face shortly after Trump got elected in 2024, again, right before Trump was going to be looking for a new Fed chair. So look, I don't know what's going on in his head. Certainly that pattern looks strange, looks suspicious, you know, and maybe he has a way that he can, explain the how these inconsistencies are actually consistent. The other thing that makes me nervous about his independence is that he has said a bunch of other things. For example, he gave a speech on the importance of Fed independence back in, I think it was in 2010, because he was on the Fed board.
He was on the Fed board then, yeah.
Yeah.
Obama was president.
Yes. And he gave this, you know, pounding the table type speech to the extent that Fed officials do anything like that, talking about the virtues of Fed independence. And this time around, you know, he says he thinks the Fed should be independent. That's like the piety that everybody has to obey and reiterate. But he also, in a panel, I want to say last year, I think it was last year, had said something like it was perfectly appropriate for Donald Trump to be jawboning the Fed on interest rates, which for decades, I mean, James, you can attest to this if you remember discussions about this during the Clinton administration, for example, but for decades, you know, the norm was that nobody in the executive branch, nobody in the White House or Treasury would make any comments on interest rates just for fear of even creating the perception that the Fed was not politically independent. You know, like you could not get the president to say anything. You couldn't get anybody on the NEC, the CEA, Treasury, whatever. Now, Donald Trump has, like with many norms, has broken this norm. And Kevin Warsh was like, yeah, seems okay. That's his right.
Yeah. Well, one final question,
oh, go on,
Catherine, about one more economic official before we go away.
Sure.
Scott Bessent. He's proven to be a Trump cheerleader. He even criticized Jay Powell for attending a Supreme Court argument on whether the Fed can be, a Fed governor can be fired. I don't know the exact number, but I looked at a number of top vacancies over there, including Deputy Treasury Secretary. What's going on with Scott Bessent?
You tell me. I don't know. He was the guy who the markets were supposed to trust. He was going to be, you know, one of the adults in the room, the guardrails, all of those cliches. And people forget that one of his very first actions upon becoming Treasury Secretary was to give Doge access
right.
to the right. confidential Treasury transactions. You know, that whole system, which historically, like it was only a couple of, you know, career civil servant technocrats who knew how those levers worked. And instead he gave access to Elon Musk's goons, essentially. So I think from the very beginning, he burst that bubble, that perception that he was going to somehow be an adult and safeguard our institutions or anything else. And, you know, in the year since then, he's done a lot of other things that I think are extremely troubling, not just, you know, failing to safeguard the Fed's independence, but basically saying all sorts of other things that are not particularly credible on tariffs, on markets, on anything else. So, yeah, it's a little surprising to me that he still has this reputation anyway of
right.
being like, you know, a trusted professional institutionalist type person.
James, do you have anything before we let Catherine go?
Catherine, I can't thank you enough. And don't be too sheepish about it. It just overperforms on the Democrats. Okay.
Not that you have any particular incentive to say that. Yeah.
Right. Catherine Rampell, whichever uniform you wear, you are the best. And we are so fortunate to have you on. And I hope you'll come back. In many midterms or any wave election, interesting challenges emerge. Some are real long shots. We're starting a new segment this week called Meet the Challengers. Our first challenger is Dr. Annie Andrews, a pediatrician taking on four-term Republican Senator Lindsey Graham in South Carolina. Dr. Andrews, my dad was a pediatrician. I have a real soft spot for pediatricians. I want to start off by saying that. Thank you. People, you know, you don't go in it for the money. And I admire you so much. But South Carolina last elected a Democratic senator in the last century. And 6 years ago, Democrats poured $132 million into Jamie Harrison's campaign against Graham, and he lost by more than 10 points. Why is it different this time for you?
Thank you so much. That was a totally different political environment. 2020 was a presidential election year. Trump was on the ballot. The Democrats were dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, so they couldn't knock on doors. And Jamie Harrison and I are very different candidates. I am not a career politician. I'm not a party person. I am a person who wants to serve in the U.S. Senate to solve the problems I dealt with for 20 years practicing as a pediatrician in children's hospitals. Lindsey Graham is also more vulnerable than he has ever been. His approval rating is 28%. We have a poll that shows me within just 6 points of him, and I have outraised him the past 2 quarters. So the political landscape could not be more different or more favorable for me than it was in 2020.
There's an awful measles outbreak in South Carolina. Do you hold Lindsey Graham responsible?
Absolutely. Lindsey Graham abdicated his responsibility as a U.S. senator when he voted to confirm RFK Jr. to lead our nation's Department of Health and Human Services. RFK Jr. is nothing more than a grifter and a conspiracy theorist who's been peddling in anti-vaccine conspiracy theories for decades. He has been the arch nemesis of our nation's pediatricians for decades, long before he ever ascended to lead HHS. And as a direct result of the vaccine anti-vax conspiracy theories he's been spreading, we have had measles outbreaks across this country, including a very active one in my home state of South Carolina, where we have over 900 documented cases.
Well, you know, the broader healthcare issue is certainly very at the top of your agenda, not just the vaccines and what are the danger RFK Jr. and his supporters are imposing. But you know, do you support restoring all those Medicaid cuts in that Republican bill and the extended affordable health care subsidies that expired? And is that, you know, that's pretty expensive, isn't it?
Yes, I support both of those things. America's healthcare system is broken. America's healthcare system has been profit motivated, not patient centered, for as long as I have been a part of it. The impending cuts to Medicaid will devastate access to healthcare for far too many South Carolinians. We already have healthcare deserts in South Carolina. We have 14 counties without an OBGYN, and these Medicaid cuts will devastate this. There's federally qualified health centers in the Midlands of South Carolina that have already closed their doors. There are 5 rural hospitals at risk of closing because of these Medicaid cuts. And yes, we also need to extend the ACA tax subsidies, but we need to take a more comprehensive approach to building a patient-centered healthcare system in this country, because I believe with every cell in my body that healthcare is a human right. And to do that, we need to remove some of the profit motivation from the system by starting with something like a public option.
Which, you know, they came close to getting some years ago, but unfortunately they cannot. You noted that Lindsey Graham is a chameleon, often changing positions, and certainly one who goes from a John McCain acolyte to a Donald Trump cheerleader displays, I suppose we could say charitably, flexibility. But you also say he's corrupt. Explain.
Yeah, so if Lindsey Graham was the same man he was 30 years ago, 25 years ago, when he started serving in the U.S. Congress, I wouldn't be in this race, because I would say, you know what, that's probably a pretty reasonable representative for the state of South Carolina. But Lindsey Graham is not a leader. He is a follower. At the beginning of his career, he was following the likes of John McCain and Mitt Romney. But now he is following the loudest, most dangerous voice in the room in Donald Trump. And South Carolina deserves so much better. He spends more time in Israel than he spends here in South Carolina. He is more concerned about foreign affairs than he is about our crumbling infrastructure and our healthcare deserts here in South Carolina. And he is corrupt. He only cares about what will help him get reelected, about what will please his special interest groups, about what will keep Donald Trump happy. I mean, he is dying on the hill of allowing himself to sue the federal government because his phone records were searched in relation to text messages he exchanged with the president around January 6th. He is just clearly in it to enrich himself and to keep his position of power.
Yeah, that bill would allow those senators to sue, but wouldn't allow you or me to sue, as I understand.
That's exactly right.
James.
So, Dr. Andrew, let's go a little bit deep and talk about you in some more depth. Tell us, where did you grow up, or what did you want to become a pediatrician? How did you segue in thinking about politics? Give us the kind of arc of the narrative of your life, please.
Yeah, so I grew up in the Midwest in Indianapolis, actually. I decided to be a doctor, if you can believe it or not, when I was four. I one day told my preschool teacher, when I grow up, I want to be a doctor and a mommy with three kids. My teacher wrote that down. My mom hung on to that paper, and I actually still have it hanging on my office wall. So my entire school career was dedicated to my goal of becoming a physician. Never once did I imagine I would pivot into politics. But I've now worked for 20 years in children's hospitals. And over those years, I really started to understand that the problems my patients and their families were facing had legislative solutions. These were systemic problems because of a failure to act by so many of our lawmakers in my state capital here in Columbia, South Carolina, and in Washington, D.C. And once I understood that these are answers that have known these are problems that have known solutions. And what we lacked was leaders with the moral authority and courage to pass these solutions. I understood that I was going to have to engage in politics on behalf of America's children and South Carolina's children. I get accused a lot of using kids for politics, but what I'm trying to do is use America's political system to help America's children.
So, I'm not sure, but we have a terrible problem in Louisiana and Florida around it. Insurance rates getting pretty high in South Carolina. Is that something that you might want to talk about? Particularly, I suspect in some of those coastal areas, they're getting pretty steep by now, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. I live here in a coastal area in the Low Country. And for folks who are, you know, have the privilege to actually be homeowners, it is becoming harder and harder and harder to find any insurance company that is willing to insure a home because of climate change, because of the increased severity of hurricanes. It doesn't seem to be an issue that rises to the top of political dialogue election season after election season, primarily, I believe, because our Republican elected officials continue to be climate science deniers, climate change deniers, because they have fossil fuel money in their pockets. But it is a very real issue here where I live in the Low Country. And, you know, the Charleston Peninsula is oftentimes underwater on sunny days because we have not taken proactive steps to address the flood mitigation problem we have. And we continue to send climate science deniers to represent us in Washington, D.C.
You should call Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. He's very knowledgeable on this. He goes around. I've done some things with him in Louisiana. He's really knowledgeable. So you run against Lindsey Graham. Everybody knows that. People want to support you. I think after they heard from you, they want to support you more. They certainly want to support you because you're not Lindsey Graham. But assume someone wanted to send you a check. How would they do that?
So to support my campaign, because it's going to take money from all across the country to defeat Lindsey Graham, and defeating Lindsey Graham is something that will benefit the entire country and frankly, the entire world. They can go to drannieandrews.com. They can donate there. There is a PO box listed at the bottom of the website. They can send a check made out to Dr. Annie Andrews for U.S. Senate. Like I said, we've outraised Lindsey the past two quarters. I've raised over $5 million. We're running a really strong campaign. We have so much momentum here on the ground, but we really have to like step up our fundraising if we're going to compete against someone who's so deeply entrenched in DC politics like Lindsey Graham is.
Wow, that's pretty good. And you got Lindsey Graham name a lot. Every 10th word has to be Lindsey Graham. I thought about Lindsey Graham. Just the name is enough to trigger people. But I would look into insurance being another pivotal part of your campaign because you're going to have the default. I'm being a little bit of a consultant here, okay? Yes, you're going to do well on healthcare issues. You're a woman, they tend to do better than men. You're a physician, they tend to do better than not physicians. But when you get in that healthcare door, you show that you have maneuverability behind other issues that affect people's lives. And clearly, insurance costs and health insurance costs. When you talk about inflation, subsidies for the South Carolinians can't deal without subsidies to buy this health care at all. And the insurance is causing them. It's a big, quote, affordability issue that Lindsey's made completely worse. Albert?
Dr. Andrews, let me ask you about a couple questions that you know Republicans will attack you on. Gun control, you're for it. Not popular in the Palmetto State, is it?
the vast majority of South Carolinians agree with my position on common sense gun safety laws. So I support the Second Amendment, but I'm also a pediatrician who has stood at the bedside of children with bullet holes in them. And it really takes one of those experiences to seek solutions. And I support common sense gun laws like universal background checks, a federal secure storage law, a federal red flag law, increased funding for gun violence prevention research, increased funding for hospital and community-based violence intervention programs. Gun violence remains the leading cause of death for children in South Carolina and in this country. And it is safe political footing for me because the vast majority of South Carolinians agree. And the only place we can't find agreement is in Washington, D.C.
But you're not taking away any of those hunters' guns.
No, I have no interest in taking away anyone's guns. I just want to see fewer children with bullet holes in them.
You also, in the past at least, have supported transgender medicine. That hurt you in your unsuccessful 2022 House race. Is that I would guess that'll be a major Republican talking point again this time.
It sure will, because they don't have any real issues to attack me on. But this is where I stand on that issue. First, I'll say I'm probably the only person running for federal office right now who's ever stood at the bedside of a trans child who's tried to kill themselves because of an adult in their lives who lacks the ability to support them, or because of bullying from an adult in their lives, like, say, South Carolina's Congresswoman Nancy Mace. And this is where I am on this issue. First of all, gender reassignment surgery has never happened for minors in the state of South Carolina, and I have never supported that. There are very few professions in this world where it is ever appropriate for someone to think about or talk about children's genitals. Being a pediatrician, it so happens to come up in my day-to-day job where I occasionally have to talk about children's genitals, but I am quite certain that being a U.S. senator is not a job where it is ever appropriate to talk about or think about children's genitals. So my question back to Lindsey Graham and the Republican Party is, why in the world do you wake up every day and think about and talk about children's genitals?
Well, good question for Lindsey Graham. Senator Graham focuses much of his time on foreign policy. You mentioned earlier he's in Israel more than South Carolina. Do you have any disagreements with him on that?
Yes, I do. First of all, like, the principle of the fact is South Carolina has two senators, just like every other state, and he needs to focus on our problems here at home before he's focused on problems overseas. The biggest disagreement I have with him is his eagerness to start more endless wars. He just said earlier this week that Israel is where he goes to plan future wars. It is not lost on me, as a mother of three minor children, that he is willing to plan these wars to send American taxpayers dollars and American children to fight in when he does not have that same investment in the future of America. He used to be a reasonable statesman who worked across the aisle on issues related to soft diplomacy, like supporting the USAID program. He has totally abandoned his position on that. And when we don't have soft diplomacy, when we don't lead with diplomacy first, of course we're going to enter more unnecessary violent conflicts.
I'm going to turn it, Dr. Andrews, back to James, but let me ask you a final. You're running against his unswerving support for Trump, but is that a liability? Trump carried South Carolina by 450,000 votes.
So interestingly, you know, Lindsey is 10 points less popular than Donald Trump here at home. And because this is a midterm year without Trump on the ballot, I think that, you know, Lindsey's loyalty to Trump is a political liability. It certainly is a liability with how extreme the second Trump administration has been on issues related to immigration and on issues like the Epstein files. There are a lot of center-right, reasonable Mitt Romney, John McCain style Republicans here in South Carolina who are completely disgusted with who Lindsey Graham has become. And Jamie Harrison only lost by 10 points. So I need about 5.1% of those folks to change their mind and to vote for me. And on top of that, related to the warmongering we were just discussing, Lindsey Graham has a lot of problems on the far right. He has an opponent, Paul Danz, who is an architect of Project 2025, who is being supported by Tucker Carlson right now. They are disgusted with Lindsey because of his warmongering, and the center right is disgusted with Lindsey for all of the reasonable reasons they should be.
Have you ever met him?
Lindsey Graham, I was at a Chick-fil-A with him once, but that was about 15 years ago before I knew anything about politics, and we did not talk.
James.
So have you challenged him to debate yet? Anything? Are y'all going to do any kind of joint appearances? Or where are you with that right
now? Nothing yet. The South Carolina primary is June 9th. I get asked nearly every room I'm in if I think Lindsey will debate me, and I'm not sure. You know, he debated Jamie Harrison several times back in 2020, but this is a different environment.
But you would debate him?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think, you know, I think Lindsey probably understands he has not a lot to gain by stepping on the debate stage with me, but he does have a lot to lose. And I would love the opportunity to debate him.
And don't be afraid to talk about it. If he won't stand up in South Carolina for you, you know, because he's too busy standing up around the world for somebody else.
That's right.
It's not too much to ask here in South Carolina that we face to face and air our differences out. I say this. I really want to help you. I've decided that what I'm going to do with my time was do what most people call third tier Senate race. I call it much higher than that. You in South Carolina, Veneman in Florida, Scott in Mississippi, and hopefully Tallarico in Texas. But I'm just so glad we got you as a candidate. I think we got a real shot. And it's always been this dream to beat Lindsey Graham. For some reason, the sight of him just makes me bust out laughing. He's actually more comical than he is pathetic, and he's really pathetic. But if you go back and everything he said about Joe Biden and what he said about this and that and all of his life, is this man's time is up. It's time for him to go and get some new, fresh leadership in that. Well, we're so glad you came on the show. We're really glad to have you. You're going to do us really proud and go out there and campaign hard.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity. I really appreciate your support. And I totally agree. This is our year to unseat him, and it will be such a wonderful feeling on election night.
Good. Sign my name.
Dr. Andrews, if you have a chance, go back and read a piece that Mark Leibovich wrote in The Atlantic about Lindsey a couple of years ago. You'll get quite a kick out of it. And again, I acknowledge I have a...
Leibo wrote on Lindsey?
Yeah. I have a real soft spot for pediatricians. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Y'all have a good day.
All right, now for the outrage of the week. Now, stick with me on this outrage. We celebrate President's Day this week. George Washington's birthday is actually this weekend. Washington, a revered figure during those founding days, could have been king. Instead, he set the pattern for our system and political continuity. The Capitol was named after him by an act of Congress, not something he asked for. He was into accomplishments, not honorific namings. The contrast to the current occupant is stunning. Trump has, illegally, I think, renamed the Kennedy Center after him and the Institute of Peace. He wants airports and train stations named after him. What a fragile ego. When, if, Democrats take control in 3 years, it will take time to undo so much of the damage. One action that can be done quickly is to strip this narcissist's name off all these buildings and institutions.
Well, as you know, on comment on that, I think his name should be on one prominent place that everybody sees it for all time, because we shouldn't erase this very dark chapter of American history. I think we got to remind people that it really happened. And I don't think we want something different, but we got to remember the bad, and we got to put him somewhere that you have to deal with the fact that he did at one time exist. For Mount Rage, it was a...
Where are we going to put it, James? I mean, I agree.
I wouldn't care. The people go crazy. You can't name the sewage plant after him because you don't go by the sewage plant. Okay? That's the first thing. It's got to be a major street, a bridge. You know, maybe the 14th Street Bridge. Call it the Trump Bridge. Got to cross it. You got to cross it. You got to know it happened. Because without reminding people that it happened, it could happen again. It really could. For my outrage, the storyline about Mark Leibovich is obviously high in top reporter about the culture at the DNC, and I want to talk about that in the larger coach of what you call the progressive advocacy groups in Washington. One of the things that has kind of almost tickled me is the Never Trumpers that have come aboard. And I mean, these are some really tough people. Sarah Longwell, you know, Crystal, Tim Miller, Mike Murphy. And I do these appearances with Mike Murphy. And they can't believe how Democrats want to sit and meet and do nothing. And they point out to people at DNC, they want to work from home. They want to work on weekends. They want to have quality of life balance. What are you doing in politics? What the fuck are you doing in politics thinking that you can make fight somebody like Trump in your pajamas? All right, come on. And all of the Washington advocacy people, I've always thought they were useless, and that's just not a thought of mine. It's a general, it was always a general thought in Democratic campaign consulting. The people who have come aboard who are now supporting Democrats and were Republicans cannot believe just how weak and pitiful and non-hungry Democratic campaign culture is. And hopefully when these people come to board, the Democrats can learn something. But they ought to, like all these young shit-ass staff people, you want to work with marginal people, good. You go to North Philadelphia. You know, send the rest of them to work on some of these Native American places in Arizona, New Mexico. Send them to barrios so they can work with people. Get them out of their pajamas or quit paying them. Jeez, what little snot-nosed assholes.
Now for our listener questions, always a favorite segment. Joel in Tampa, Florida, James, says, our country is now completely ruled by money from top to bottom. I hear talk of fixing this and that, but how can anything be fixed when money remains a controlling factor?
Well, it's always been a big factor. It's now maybe the only factor. I mean, everything is for sale. I appreciate the question. I think the magnitude is this. If you took all of the corruption in the United States government from the year, say, 1789 through even Trump's first term through January 20th, 2025, and then from January 20th, 2025 to where we are now, February the 19th, 2026, there's more been stolen in that time than the accumulated rest of the country. That's what I believe how big of a money problem you got. It's everywhere. It's right out in the open. It's in Bitcoin. It's the people buying the stuff. It's unbelievable. But you ask the right question. Unfortunately, the answer is we're stealing at a rate that is unprecedented in American history. Unprecedented.
You got our peace negotiators, Witkoff and Jared over there. You know, if they don't have a good day in negotiations, they're still making money. It's really outrageous. Joseph in Schenectady, New York says, with no more presidential approval ratings, it seems to me that Trump regime has pressured Gallup into changing what data collects and what data reports. What do you think about it? Well, first of all, Joseph, there are approval ratings from other polls. I think Gallup made a terrible mistake. I don't know if they got pressure or not from Trump. It would not surprise me. But the import of those approval ratings was not the number, but the historical comparisons. You know, if Trump is at 43%, you can say, well, that's pretty bad. And if someone says, well, X was at 44% and they got reelected, I don't think that happened. But that was the importance. And I don't know why Gallup did it, but I think it was a huge, huge disservice to the public.
Well, okay. I think I know why they did it. There's a repression. For 88 years, and people would pay attention to it. They had a historical database and everything. All of a sudden, when the current administration is complaining and they're complaining even about trying to shut Fox polls down. And you just roll out of bed one morning and say, you know, I think we're going to ask presidential approval anymore. It doesn't really fit with our current mission. And I looked, and they're nice people. They're kind of people I did a speech for them not very long ago. in their businesses, so many different things. And Sam, the political business, I'm sure, is not hardly anything of what they're about. But of course, they were pressured, and the person said, in their name will be in history, and it'll be shit all over. That's the decision they made.
Jay in St. Petersburg, Florida, asked you, James, the nation has had many political parties in the past that no longer exist. What will it take to push this failed remnant of the Republican Party into oblivion?
Well, first of all, the Republican Party that I knew is in oblivion. It basically doesn't exist anymore. I mean, there used to be a Republican Party that actually would at least talk about deficits, okay? They claimed to care about the military. They came, you know, believed in kind of lower, somewhat lower tax rates, lower regulation. I don't know. That's all gone. It's all gone. It was just completely taken over by Trump, its members, and everything else. And maybe that party won't exist anymore. I have no idea. To the extent that some of them are coming over to the Democratic Party, I welcome and maybe they can change this culture that we got in the Democratic Party in Washington, D.C. I'm hoping.
Greg in Atlanta, Georgia asks, given that the Senate may now be in play for Democrats, how much of a risk is that ultra-progressive candidates may win primaries and be defeated in the general, such as Graham Plattner in Maine, Abdul El Sayed in Michigan, and Jasmine Crockett in Texas? You know, Greg, it's a worry. I don't think it's a worry in Michigan. I think the contest in Michigan is basically between Haley Stevens and Mallory McMurrow. I think McMurrow is a much stronger candidate. I think Saeed would lose, but I don't think he's going to be the nominee. In Maine, I'm not. I still would probably bet on Susan Mills. Janet Mills, the governor. She would be a stronger candidate. The big enchilada here, if you will, is Texas in the May 3 primary. If Jasmine, it now appears at least a probably 60% probability that the ethically challenged Ken Paxton will win the Republican primary, at least in a runoff. He's been indicted. He was impeached by the House there. He's a really unsavory character. He is the one Texas Republican who is beatable. And James Tallarico can beat him. Jasmine Crockett cannot beat him. I don't care what the polls show right now. That's just a reality. So that's a danger. If Tallarico wins that primary, I think the Democrats, if it's Tallarico versus Paxton, I bet on the Democrats. If it's Tallarico, if it's Crockett versus Paxton, I'd bet on the Republicans.
Well, okay, let's talk about Texas. The Republicans manipulated Crockett into the race. They started leaking polls. Okay. Yep. Secondly, you know, because when CBS said they didn't want to air the Tallarico interview, it's pretty clear that the Ellisons and Barry Weiss didn't want to give Tallarico any help. As it turned out, they gave him help on steroids because of the way they handled it. So you say, I think Tallarico is a stronger candidate than Crockett. Well, you know the NRSC thinks that, and you know they polled it. You know CBS News and the Ellisons and Brendan Carr think that because they tried to keep Tallarico out of the air. I mean, it's pretty clear who they don't want, and that should be the person we want.
Yeah. James, this is picking up on this. Frank in Long Island wants to know, what are the factors that make you, Mr. Carville, so sure about the midterms pointing to a big win?
Okay, let's start with it. Historically, it's probably 80%. You get didn't get one in 202, didn't get kind of one in 98 so much, but other than that, our 2022, they're pretty predictable. Secondly, presidential approval is totally in the toilet. Third, I look at recruitment, and the Democrats are just recruiting everybody that they want, and Republican retirement's at an all-time high. I clearly look at polling, but more than anything else, I look at election returns. And if you look at election returns and you place the kind of value I do on people actually voting, it leads you to the inescapable conclusion that I've arrived at, the Democrats are going to win the Senate back. And I think that people who say, well, it's a 40% chance, or, you know, you got to admit they got a kind of an outside chance, are just not looking at the data. In the accumulated data from five different data points, polling, history, retirements, actual election returns, presidential approval, direction of the country. And it's just hard to look at all of that and not have that point to a Monsieur. And I'm always asking people to tell me how does it not happen? And you get some people who have some better answers than others, but it's going to be hard for it not to happen.
Well, I agree with you if the most winnable candidates win several of those primaries. If they don't, then I think it's going to be more. Then I'm right. Jill in Murfreesboro, Tennessee says, what's in store for the Democratic Party and what kind of a candidate should we run in 28? I'm loving Newsom. We need an arrogant, benevolent asshole. Thoughts? Jill, let me give you my thoughts. Don't worry about it now. It'll take care of itself. Worry about November, this November. Most important midterm elections in your lifetime. I don't know, you're undoubtedly younger than we are, but most important midterm elections in our lifetime. And after November, then focus on 28, whether it's Newsom, whether it's Beshear, whether it's Wes Moore, that'll then take care of itself. That's, you know, it's a year and, 15 months before there's a caucus or a primary. So, Jill, right now, focus all of your attention on 2026.
Jill, listen to me. I 100% agree with what Al just said. I've studied about no 28. I get through 26. Let's pick up as many seats as we can. And we'll do that. We'll be plenty of 28 stuff ahead of us.
Yes. Finally, Susan in District 13, Florida. I'm not sure where. I guess it's CD 13. Yeah. She says, I'm running as a Democrat in the midterms. She's running against Representative Luna. I'm just starting my campaign. I'm looking for guidance and support. You have any advice for me? Are Democrats like me running against incumbents?
Yeah, Representative Luna's last name is Tick. So just call her Lunatic because that's what she is. look, good luck there. I'm pretty bullish about Florida. I'm really bullish about David Jolly, our gubernatorial candidate, and really bullish about Alexander Vindman, our Senate candidate. So I think if you get any kind, I think you'd have a good wind at your back, and you go, girl. You got a lot of gumption. Let's go get them. Lunatic.
Yeah, Susan, keep us posted on how it's going, okay? Listen, please keep those questions coming in. If we didn't get to yours this week, we'll try to get to it next week. It is so hard. I think the most difficult task, James, I have every week is picking which 7 questions we're going to choose from because they are so good and we really appreciate it. So please keep them coming. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Superpower, Smalls, Green Chef, and Ultra Pouches in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You also can find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review, and we'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.